Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Stephen Lubar. He's a former museum curator and director, and is professor of American Studies at Brown University. And we're talking about his new book, Inside the Lost Museum, Curating Past and Present. Steve, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
A pleasure to be here.
This is a wonderful book. This book took me by surprise, and I love books like that. This book should be read by every museum professional, docents, curators, directors. Every chapter is worth an entire interview, and we're only going to be able to talk about a little bit. But one thing I want to talk about, there's a Greek chorus throughout this book, and that's John Whipple Porter Jenks and his Jenks Museum. You got to talk to me about that, about why Jenks and why the Jenks Museum.
Sure. The John Whipple Porter Jenks was even in his day, he was an old-fashioned naturalist. He was born in 1819, went to Brown, class of 1837, and became a school teacher, but always loved natural history. Became a collector in the 1850s. He was collecting for Agassiz at the Museum of Comparative Zoology up at Harvard. Collected for the Smithsonian, collected 500 mice for the Smithsonian. And when he retired as a school teacher, he was teaching in Middleborough, Massachusetts, he went back to his alma mater and said he was horrified that Brown University had no museum. And so in 1872, he said, give me some space and I will build you a museum. And that's what he did. He got the first floor of the science building, Rhode Island Hall, and started bringing his own collections in, convinced alumni to give their collections to the university. And from 1872 until his death in 1894, he built a pretty wonderful collection, mostly natural history, but lots of ethnography, things from around the world, some interesting local history objects, about 50,000 objects that he brought to Brown and put on display and used for teaching, both for students and open to the community as well.
But the museum is no more.
The museum is no more. In 1894, he died. It had already begun to seem a little bit old-fashioned. He didn't believe in evolution. He hadn't kept up with the times. And the scientists wanted their space back. it was labs were fashionable and museums were out of fashion. And so after his death, the museum held on for a while, but by 1914, 20 years later, it was officially shut down. Almost everything was put into storage, and then a few decades later, when there was no interest at all, the collections went to the Brown University dump, and there they stayed.
Some things were rescued because there was a contemporary art installation called the Lost Museum based on the Jenks collection.
That's right. So a few things were saved. Some things that had seemed like ethnography became interesting to art historians and went to the museum at the Rhode Island School of Design. Some things went to the Roger Williams Museum of Natural History, what was called the People's University, a city-run museum that's still there. And then a number of things that were stored in an attic were discovered in the 1960s when that building was being torn down, and went to the museum's went to the university's Hoffenreffer Museum of Anthropology. And then a few other things sort of got scattered to the winds, and the shell collection, the shell collection ended up in Long Island. So bits and pieces were saved. Most of the taxidermy was lost. And some things that seemed interesting to other parts of the university got saved. The antique coin collection went to archaeology, and the rocks and minerals went to geology.
The point of this, and every chapter in this book begins with Jenks in some fashion and the museum, is that that's sort of the beginning point when we think about the evolution and the changes that have gone in. And we're not just talking about natural history museums, but all museums, which is what the focus of your book is every kind of museum. You can start with Jenks as the example of this is what it was. This is how he thought about things. And you trace it after that. And it's in that way, the reader is really able to understand the evolution of museums and collecting and curating.
That's right. What I'm after is thinking, using Jenks as an example, sometimes a good one and sometimes a bad one. He's a good example of the ambitious collecting curator who, you know, stops at nothing to get the objects he thinks the museum needs. He's a bad example of someone who's taking good care of his collections and keeping track of them and keeping good records about where they came from and what they mean.
And there was also no storage. He put literally everything he had on view.
Everything he had was on view, which was fairly common for natural history museums of that day. The idea that there should be a reserve collection and a public collection started in the 1870s or 80s. The Smithsonian decided at one point that there would be the Scholars Museum and the People's Museum, and you could actually make the collection more useful for both kinds of use by separating it. And it was quite a controversial idea at the time.
Now, there are so much parts, we're going to have you come back and talk about it, because the storage aspect of this book is fascinating about how museums have thought about storage and what's to get storage. But I want to talk about the very end of the book is probably the sort of crowning, for me, the crowning important chapters about what use is a museum. Did Jenks think museums should be useful to the general public?
Yes. He mostly thought of them as being useful for teaching for his students in a different way than we thought about them. He was the head of the Brown Taxidermy Club. So Brown students at one point learned taxidermy, how to stuff and preserve animals. He would use the collections to teach zoology. So he was very much interested in them being useful that way. He was not as interested in the sort of usefulness that museums are interested in now, which is reaching out to a very broad audience,
right,
and also reaching back to the people that collections come from and making the collections useful in a much broader way.
People have criticized, and you have these criticisms in the book, certain museums have been described as collections of miscellaneous curios or junk shops. And when I read that in your book, I thought about my early days in the 60s, hanging around the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard in Cambridge, which just had these vast collections of everything, just all up there on the wall. And I loved that kind of space. But there's been a move against that. And as a matter of fact, within Harvard, there was what was called the molecular wars, where molecular biology became really popular, and those kinds of museum collections were sort of frowned on.
Yeah. So this has been, especially in natural history museums, there's this long debate about, so what good are these collections really, and what are they useful for? And as science has changed, those collections have found different uses or seemed less useful at some times. When biologists are interested in taxonomy and figuring out what species there are and how they relate to one another, the collections seem very useful. As biology, and especially after World War II, became more interested in how biological mechanisms work and interested in molecular side of things, those questions seem less useful. And then again, what happened later on, as you could start to work with the collections not as entire organisms, but to start to look at their DNA, you could start to do new and more interesting work. One of the morals of the book is that museum collections turn out to be useful sometimes in surprising ways.
Right.
They're collected for one purpose, and they're found useful in for some other purpose.
And museums have also had a history of having an agenda. As you write in the book, in 19th century British museums, they were part of the social reform agenda. What did that mean?
Absolutely. One of the things that museum historians have started to point out is that museums were places to teach people how to behave.
Right, right.
You didn't touch things, you looked at things. And looking was sort of a higher class way of
And you were quiet. You were quiet.
You were quiet. You paid attention. It was a place that you would go and listen and learn from people who knew more and were better than you. Now, of course, I don't think that museums ever really were all that successful in that. There's a wonderful description. The very first museum evaluation is at the end of the 19th century in England. And the curator who's doing the work says, you know, these kids are just running through the museum and they're not really reading any of our labels and they're not really paying attention, except for a few of them, that maybe they're getting something out of it. Maybe it's worth it just for that. And of course, that's always the case. You, as a curator, you put all this work into trying to tell a particular story and trying to get folks to understand the objects and the bigger picture. But what always happens is that, it's free-range learning. kids, visitors to museums get what they want out of it. There's a lot of choice in the what somebody visits a museum gets. And so that's one of the wonderful things about it, is that it is not a lecture. It's a seminar. It's a back and forth. Visitors do what they want, and you can lead them on, and you can hope that they understand things the way you'd like it understood, but it's very much a free choice learning.
I know that to be true. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Stephen Lubar. He's a former museum curator and director and is professor of American Studies at Brown University. And we're talking about his book. And this book should be read by anybody who loves museums, who's been to a museum or works in a museum. Inside the Lost Museum, Curating Past and Present. See, I was fascinated in your book about art museums in particular, where there's been these long-running battles about whether art museums should be useful or, as you write it in the book, proudly useless. Talk to me. I mean, it started out with John Cotton Dana and Benjamin Ives Gilman. Talk to me about these two opposing views of what art museums should do.
Opposing views is right. So I'll give you a little bit of background. John Cotton Dana was the founder and director of the Newark Museum in Newark, New Jersey. Comes out of the library world. He starts off as director of the Newark Library. His idea is that museums are to be useful, and by that he means that they're for a broad population. They should be training artists to be better artists. They should be training industrialists and industrial workers to have a better sense of aesthetics and make more beautiful things. But he's perfectly happy, for example, to put on display the examples of the industrial pottery produced in Newark, or even examples of the objects that immigrants had brought with them from their home countries to make them proud of themselves. So a very clear sense that museums are to be useful to the population, to the economy of the city, that kind of thing. Benjamin Ives Gilman is secretary, curator, for a little while director of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. He comes out of a very different tradition. He's trained in psychology at Harvard and is a true believer in art is for its own sake. You're not going to teach people with art. They're going to be better people because of it.
Just because they're there in the presence of art.
Exactly. He's the person who invents the museum docent, comes up with the term docent, and he has this wonderful line about A docent is somebody who's already friends with the art and is happy to introduce you to it, and you can become its friend too. So it's this sense of art is for the soul. It's not for practical purposes. And this is a big debate that goes on in art museums from that time to today.
I was going to say that when you get to the section in your book about learning from things, when we get to the art museums, there are still people who are very firm of the fact that the only thing you should be doing in an art museum is learning about those objects of art, and that's it. You should not be using art to teach other things.
Right, and there are people who are very strongly on the other side of that debate, too, that art museums should be useful. And so you have programs that, well, anything you can imagine, that you can, art museums are places for artists. There are programs, art museums are for citizenship, and a strong feeling in some art museums that they're for building community.
That's right.
And that's, all of those things are possible. One of the stories of the book, one of the morals of the book that I was struck by was how many different ways museums can be used, how open-ended they are as educational and useful institutions.
And there's all sorts of interesting arguments that museums make for their usefulness. And one of the ones I want to talk about right off is the economic import of, and this can be a trap too, where you think like this museum, brings X amount of dollars into the community, into the city. And then there's what you call the Bilbao effect, where, if you build this big flashy museum in the middle of nowhere, it's going to change everything. It seems to me dangerous to sort of make that your major reason for existence is the economic import of museums. That could be a sort of a weird road to follow down.
Yeah, you can see the appeal of it, though.
I totally understand that. I totally get that you want to sell it. But there are people who are very nervous about that argument because you don't want to just talk dollars and cents.
Right. So this goes back to this many different ways the museum can be useful. The Guggenheim Bilbao is the example that's always pointed to. Build a big, flashy museum in a rundown industrial city and suddenly it becomes a tourist attraction. That model has not worked very well for the other proposed Guggenheim museums. Most of them never quite took off. On the other hand, a museum like the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York or MFA in Boston is very clear. If the Met puts out for many of their exhibits, this is how many tourists attract. This is how many dollars were spent in New York City because this museum was here. And in part, those places are trying to explain why they should get city or state funding or why they shouldn't pay taxes and trying to make a case for their economics. Especially for new buildings when you're trying to raise money and trying to get state or other government support. It's an important part of of the argument that museums make. I agree with you. It's not the most important way that museums should argue for why they're important, but you can see the appeal of it.
There's so many ways that museums sort of are important. One of them is, and I love this section of the book, museums strengthen communities. And one of the examples is museums by and for, this is a quote from your book, racial, ethnic, and cultural groups stimulate a definite kind of community. And a great example of that is the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Talk to me about that, about how that's really forming a community.
The community museums have their start in the 1960s and 70s. There's African-American Museum in Detroit, Hispanic Museum, Mexican Museum in Chicago, founded in part as community organizing, in part as saying our history is important and valuable, and one of the ways to build that community is to know that history, to say to build a museum to show that it's important. And it's been very much the case also on in Native American museums, where many tribes have built museums to reclaim that history, to show it off, both for their own members and for a larger audience. They've been criticized for that. The longtime museum exhibit reviewer for the New York Times, you know, said this is just bad propaganda. They do bad history in order to try to prove to make the case about the community. But they serve an important role, and some of them do very good history to make the case for the community. The new museum at the Smithsonian, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, is an example of trying to both build that community to explain black history for a black audience, but also to very much tie it into a larger story to say you can't understand American history without
right.
understanding African American history. And it does a wonderful job of doing serving both of those ends, both for the community and for the nation as a whole.
I want to talk about museum education just for a few minutes. And we cannot do everything that your book covers justice, but I want to quote, there's a quote by Adele Silver, editor of a 1978 survey of museum education. And this quote that you have in the book really struck me. Those who run American museums have never fully agreed on what museums should teach, to whom, or for what ends. But from the outset, museums have undertaken to teach someone something.
Yes.
And that sort of sums up the confused state of affairs.
Well, it goes back to that point I made earlier. Museums are useful in so many ways, in part because they're a collection of objects that can be sorted and explained and put and valued in so many different ways. If you look at museums today and look at the educational programs that they offer, it really is everything from toddler programs to programs for adults with memory loss.
That's right.
From little kids to elderly folks. And they all find ways of relating to the object in museums. And I guess that's the appeal I mentioned earlier about every visitor gets to make their choices about how they look at the museum. And the same is true for museum education programs. They can take this enormously malleable resource of lots of objects and have you look at them in different ways and get different things out of it. That quote is right on the money. I think even today, you can look at it as they haven't quite figured out who they're teaching and about what, but they go from that to say, we can teach everyone about almost anything.
One of the trends nowadays is to put the collections online. And what's your opinion about doing that and how that's affecting education? That seems to open up a whole other realm of possibilities.
It does. When museums started putting their collections online in the 80s and 90s, the fear was that if we put our collections online, nobody will actually come to the museum. And it's turned out to be exactly the opposite. The more the collections are online, the more people want to come and look at them.
They want to see the actual object.
They want to see the actual thing. They didn't know what was there. One of the statistics I was absolutely surprised by, when there's surveys that are done of the general public about how many objects are in museums, the general assumption is that almost everything they have is on display. That if you go to a natural history museum, what you see is what they've got. But of course, natural history museums maybe display 1% of what
they
have.
That's right.
Most of the collections are in storage and there for scientists to look at. Same with art museums, just a few percent on display. When you start to put those collections online, and now that most big museums have almost all of their collections online, you start to get a sense of the enormous range and diversity of what's there, and start to understand the choices that curators are making when they put things on display, the choices that they made when they collected those things, and you really get a sense of the depth of what's possible in a museum. So you put those collections on display, and suddenly they're available in places nobody ever thought about, not only on the museum website, but on Wikipedia, in Pinterest boards, you name it. You can find museum collections that before, if you were lucky, you could go and visit them in the museum, and mostly they were in storage, and you couldn't even go visit them.
We're almost out of time, and I just want to mention there's a wonderful section at the end of your book called The Promise of Museums. And one of the things you talk about is museums can change lives. And I have to say, in all honesty, I can name you the museums that changed my life. I grew up around museums in Boston, the Museum of Fine Arts, the Museum of Science in Boston, the Museum of Comparative Zoology in Harvard. Those three museums made me who I am today. And I bet you have museums, too, that changed you as a person.
I do. I grew up in Philadelphia.
Oh, wow.
The Franklin Institute was, at that point in the 60s and 70s, an old-fashioned science museum in some ways. But it just had the most wonderful things to play with.
And,
places you could just wander through. It had old stuff. It had historical things, which is what I ended up being interested in. But it also had, just wonderful technology and science exhibits on display. And one of the things I remember from my visit there, they had a locomotive, an enormous, huge, full-scale locomotive. And you could go into it and push the levers and play with it, and it would move every so often. I remember being absolutely convinced that I had found the magic button and pushed the right lever and made this thing start.
Oh, man, I totally identify with that. We're completely out of time. We could be talking about museums, and we're going to have you back, Stephen, because there's so much in this book to talk about.
Wonderful.
My guest tonight has been Stephen Lubar, former museum curator and director, professor of American Studies at Brown University, and we've been talking about his book, Inside the Lost Museum, Curating Past and Present. Stephen, we'll talk to you later.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.